I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal, meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Stacey Flynn is the co-founder and CEO of Evernew, a textile company that recycles discarded cotton garments to create premium renewable fibers that are tackling the rampant pollution and labor exploitation issues in the current fast fashion market. She's actively reinventing the textile and apparel business model to preserve the future of apparel. What's interesting to me is your history, and I love talking about your history, so I want to go back.
Okay.
So you grew up in where?
Rochester, New York.
Right. But you spent part of your earlier years with your father.
In Texas.
In Texas.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Five years.
5 years. And that was your high school years?
Yeah, it was high school from 6th grade to 11th grade, something like that.
And then you came back to Rochester.
Yep.
And here you come back to Rochester. You have no idea what you want to do with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you go work in a fabric store.
Yes.
And there was something about that that absolutely turned you on.
And when I was living in Texas for those 5 years, my stepmother was a master seamstress and she taught me how to sew. So my first project was an Izzy Miyake coat.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I was like 15 and it was the dead of summer and I made this wool Izzy Miyake coat. And in church, it's like, you know, my family, very conservative Catholic, and me, clearly
not in your Izzy Miyake.
Yeah. who in this lineup does not belong?
And they shipped you back to Rochester.
Yes. And then I got too big for Rochester. I was like, I got to get out of here.
But I love the story is that you decided FIT was a school that you need to go to.
The only school.
The only school.
Yep.
And you went down there.
Yes.
And?
I applied.
And you didn't get in.
Didn't get in. Yeah. I had poor academic standing because of all the shifting that was happening in my younger years. And, you know, I didn't know at the time. They discovered it at FIT, actually, that I was an extreme kinesthetic learner.
That is correct, which I think is amazing. But you sat inside that office and basically said to him.
David Weingartner, the head of admissions.
I'm going to sit here until you let me in.
Yeah. I went in and made an appointment with him. And then went into his office and said, this is the only school for me. And I'd like to tell you what's not in my file. I am not leaving your office without a letter of acceptance. And he said, Miss Flynn, I've been doing this a long time. And if you have the audacity to come into my office to tell me that I made a mistake, maybe you're worth a second look. So he looked at my file and accepted me under academic probation.
And so here you go. You go off to school. You're super happy and you are struggling at school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very poor grades.
Very poor grades. And you, yeah. Right. And
well, Professor Papillo kicked my friend Jose and I out of her program entirely. We were pattern making majors and we were competing with people that had gone to fashion high, and only Jose and I didn't have drafting and draping experience. So Professor Papillo was like, you're out. You're both out. And if you go quietly, I'll give you a C. And if
but
you,
a C was going to screw you in not being able to stay in school.
Yes, it would have long term. It would have been a problem. But my other grades were good, except in her class. So then I found textiles. And same problem, though. I was
struggling.
Struggling. Yeah, Professor Barker. I was getting like a 35 or a 40 out of 100 on his tests. And I went to him in tears because I was afraid that I'd get kicked out. And he was like, it doesn't make any sense. You show up, you pay attention, you're not sleeping. Like, this doesn't make any sense to me. He was like, come with me. And he brought me into the lab and he gave me a blue swatch. And he says, I want you to dye an undyed piece of fabric this color blue. So I measured it using the spectrophotometer, measured my dye, time, temperature, liquor ratio. And I got to a nearly perfect metameric match on my first attempt. And he was like, okay, maybe blue is too easy. Let's try green and brown. Those are harder. So I tried them and I was within delta on both colors. And he was like, I have to train you differently. He's like, you are an extreme kinesthetic learner. I've worked with people like you and you need to do it before I test you. And as soon as he made that shift, I mean.
You flew.
I flew. And I learned how I learn. And ever since I've learned how I learn, I've been able to take that really far. But it took a long time. I was 21 when I learned how I learn.
Right. And you, people who learn like you, are like what percentage of overall people?
I have no idea. Probably. But I know my niece is this way as well. And I'm watching her struggle. And then I'm watching her, you know, do incredible things, like from a technical perspective. She excels at science.
So if you do it, you get it.
Yes.
But you can't be tested on it in paper.
Correct.
Amazing. And so then you went on and you went to work. What was your – when you left?
Well, while I was at FIT, I was working for a luxury home furnishings company in Tribeca. And I was piloting everything I was learning on this woman's business. It was called Is Design. And it was amazing. I think in – we took her business from $300,000 in sales to over $2 million in about a year,
That's amazing.
It was really great. But I cut her cost of goods sold. So she was paying $45 for this tape yarn. I asked her if I could resource it for her. I found a yarn supplier down in the Southeast that made the yarn for $9 a pound, found a package dyer that could dye it in Philadelphia, and then got a landed product to her studio for $11.50.
So you changed her entire business.
Changed her whole business. And then we started having fun.
Right. But then you ended up going, at one point, you had an opportunity to go to Target.
Well, I went to DuPont first.
Right. You went to DuPont first.
And that was interesting. DuPont was...
It's a large company.
Huge company. The manager for the area had been in her new role for quite a period of time. So I walked into a department that had... fallen down, really. And I was attracted to it because it was so sideways. I wanted to fix it.
How'd you work without the whole team in there?
Oh, man. My dad actually helped me. So my dad had a long history working in management, and he helped me create different departments. I promoted supervisors to run those departments. And instead of having 15 direct reports, I had 3. And then they had people working under them. And then I built capacity in the supervisors. And it was a great experience for me to work in that way. But it wasn't long before I got the job at Target. I think I was there for 2 or 3 years.
And Target, didn't they, when you went to see Target and you started doing all your research, didn't they think that you were stealing in the store?
Yeah, well, they thought I was a spy for like Walmart or something. And I went into Target jail in the back of the store and they had to verify that I did indeed have an interview. And while the head of security was making the call to corporate, I was there with the store manager and I said, I really do have an interview. Do you mind if I just take this time to get some information from you? Mm-hmm. Because I am going to blow this interview out of the water. And he was laughing and he's like, I am so sorry. I have a feeling that you're legit.
That's hilarious. But that's how you learn. You went in totally. And you totally wanted to learn the business.
Yeah, I wanted to learn the business. I wanted to put myself in the shoes of the person that I would be working for, who was Michael Alexan, who is the VP. And I was the first hire into the company. And Michael told me he had interviewed over 20 people for the position. But he's like, you want to know why I hired you, Stace? He's like, you showed me how you think. Even if it's flawed, even if it's not exactly how I would think, you gave me exposure into how you think and you completely reduced the risk of bringing a new person on to start this department. You eliminated that
because he got
equation.
You before you walked in the door.
Yeah.
And you were involved in creating that khaki.
Yes. I worked on their Ultimate Chino program.
And that was competing with the Gap at that point.
With everybody.
Well, with everyone. Yeah. But I do remember when the Gap had those phenomenal ads where they all did like the jitterbug.
Yeah.
And Target came out with something very similar that was a no wrinkle free khaki pant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something you created.
I did the Ultimate Chino. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you went on to go overseas. And that was when you decided this is a terrible way that we went materials.
Well, Eddie Bauer moved me to Seattle because my brother was just starting a family in Seattle. And I had lived away from family for 15 years.
And you had had enough.
I had had enough. So I say I went into retirement because I lived on a houseboat on Lake Union. I flew around the world making jeans with my designers. I was managing the development of the men's and women's denim businesses, which was so fun, but it was about a quarter of my normal capability. So after about two or three years, I kind of got bored and I was like, what's the next big thing for me? I've got to get back into the game because I wasn't at the age where I should be retiring. So I decided to start focusing on materials reuse, making textiles out of waste at that time. And that's when the startup Rethink hired me to develop their collection.
And is that before or after you went to China and you opened the door and you couldn't see the person across the way from you?
That was during. So Rethink hired me and they sent me to China. And that's where I saw the subcontracted areas. So I'd been to China so many times before this trip, but I didn't realize how much of the work is subcontracted. And I didn't realize that the facilities that I may have been walking into could have been just almost show facilities because they were huge. I mean, the amount of volume that, you know, I'll never forget the first time I traveled to China for Target, I managed 20 of those four-way racks on the floor pad, mm-hmm. you know, those four-way racks.
I know exactly what you're
racks.
Talking about, yes.
25% of one rack was two football fields of looms running.
That's amazing.
It is a lot of fabric, and I felt like I was important. I was doing something really important in the world, and I felt very proud of the scale at which I was working. So when I went to China in 2010 and I saw what my work was really doing to the world.
The havoc it was taking on the environment.
Yes, and people living under and in this environment. All of that pride turned to shame. And
you could barely see across the way to the driver.
I couldn't see my colleague who was standing right next to me. And then we took the elevator up to our room. Midway through the room to the ceiling was this cloud from outside hovering over the heads of their corporate team. We sat at a table under this cloud and we talked about how we could do business. And like nothing strange was happening. You know, most people were wearing masks, some weren't. And I don't even think it would matter if you were wearing a mask
right,
or not.
Because it was so awful.
It was so bad. So bad. And then the water, we take for granted we have garbage pickup, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's like a really, like, you don't imagine a world where you don't have
your
like
garbage picked up.
Proper sanitation, you know? But there's garbage goes into ditches, it ends up in streams, it ends up in rivers, it ends up in lakes, and it ends up in the ocean or wherever it ends up. But that was the situation when I was there. And I began adding up how many billions of yards of fabric I had personally created up to that point in my career. And I became linked to the cause of the problem.
And that was your aha moment.
It was my aha moment. But before I got to that point, I was like, okay, what are you going to do about this? Because in the past, I was able to convince myself that I added value in other ways. Creating jobs that they might not have otherwise.
Right.
Creating, you know, economic opportunities. I did not I wanted to figure out, you know, okay, I could pretend like this isn't happening and just convince myself I'm still okay. Or I could switch industries, but I mean,
you had incredible depth knowledge in an industry. How are you going to switch? Right.
And
you love your industry.
Yeah. And once you've got a passion in your system, like, I mean, all roads lead to conversations about textiles with me. Like, it's ridiculous how much I love fabric and love talking about nuances of fabric. And I couldn't imagine disassembling myself from what I loved. But I was like, maybe I should be a florist. I love flowers. And then I was like, okay, stop right there. Maybe later. So then I was like, all right, the only thing that will satisfy my soul and my ambitions is to fix this problem. And, you know, standing in the middle of this thing, I felt so tiny, but I also was
empowered.
I say incredibly well-trained and pissed.
Yeah.
You know, so how do I leverage that to actually bring this cloud down? Because, you know, we are these problems aren't caused by nameless, faceless corporations. They're caused by individuals who are working under bad design elements.
Completely.
And I want to fix it.
So you went back and then you went to a school, actually, for a couple of years.
Totally. So the Pinchots created Bainbridge Graduate Institute. It was the first sustainable MBA program in the country. And, you know, coming from the textile and apparel industry and going into the world of sustainability, I was a little concerned because
they're not thinking about that there.
No. And I was like, all right, I'm going to be hanging out with a bunch of hippies and my friends in New York are going to say, what the hell do you think you're doing? Are you a hippie now, Stace? Like, what is happening here? But I went into...
You put your Mizrahi jacket to us.
I know, right? Yeah, I got to be me. So I went into this school and they have these, it's a hybrid program. So they convene in the woods in this beautiful natural forest and they talk about sustainable business. And I was, when I went there, just like FIT, as soon as I got to FIT, I was hooked. As soon as I got to BGI, which is now owned by Presidio, I was hooked because of the way that they were talking and the concepts that they were talking about. But I really went in with the intention of leveraging exactly what I did at FIT, contacts and networks, you know, and who, what you learn, you can do a lot of things with. But if you want to meet people who are, who can help you get yourself to the next level and then leverage their networks, that was what I was interested in doing and what I did do. We studied the whole supply system from start to finish. Like, how do we make textiles? And what we discovered were two things. This was actually my research in grad school. 90% of the global apparel market is made from cotton or polyester. Both fibers require massive natural resources.
Tremendous amount of water.
So much water.
I mean,
for
what
cotton.
Is it like? What is how many gallons they per t-shirt?
I think the EPA says like 700 gallons for a t-shirt of water. Goes into a t-shirt.
And we're talking clean water.
Clean.
We're not talking about gray water.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the natural resources required for cotton and polyester are massive. But then as subject matter experts, we take this fiber, we spin it into yarn, we knit, weave, dye, print, finish, cut and sew garments that we elegantly ship to every human on the planet. And globally, we're throwing away 50 million tons of clothing every year. So we knew
huge problems.
Yeah, two huge problems bookending the situation. So the design challenge became clear. If there was a way to take that waste, break it down and turn it into new fiber, that was the linchpin of impact for the system. But at that time, I could never have conceived that we would have stumbled across something that had so much impact. Capability and beauty, because we can simulate the best qualities of cotton, the best qualities of polyester, and the best qualities of rayon or silk. That's 94% of the global market we can simulate using our regenerative technology.
So essentially you're taking, you can take the 50 million tons that are thrown, break those things down, and then essentially create an endless cycle of all the materials that we've already made in this world.
Well, they're only about a third of that 50 million ton heap works on our technology because we only have the cotton portion right
Got
now.
It.
The PET
right now.
Right now. The PET, well, we have the PET portion right. as well. We're not deploying it. But cotton and polyester are the two biggest, and those are the two that need to be addressed. There are we're working on the polyester separation. We can separate cotton from polyester on a molecular level, and then we can separate polyester from – we can do it the opposite way too, the cotton from the polyester. There are philosophical debates around the use of polyester in apparel, and
there has been for many reasons.
Many, many reasons. And, you know, the truth is if anything happens to cotton, guess who picks up the market share? Polyester.
Totally polyester.
Because, you know, it's not dependent on water. And in 2011, when we saw pricing spike from 85 cents to 240 a pound, it was because China locked their market and India locked their market, and brands and retailers were like, who cares what price is doing? If I don't get my product, I have no earning margin and cash flow.
Right.
If those racks are empty and I can't sell something, I'm out of business.
Right.
So it was a catastrophic scare for a lot of brands. And it was an expensive event for sure. But, you know, water, natural resource damage, all of these things create a tremendous amount of risk for the supply system on a platform level.
So when you started doing this, you went in with one concept and it evolved into others, right?
Yeah, gosh, it was so interesting. Like when we took, I think I met you when we had just taken a t-shirt from a solid to a liquid and back to a solid with a syringe.
Correct.
And I would walking into people's offices with three beakers saying, I'm going to fundamentally change your business with this. And they were like, you're crazy. You are crazy. If you think you're going to change a $70 billion business with this idea. And I was like, you have no idea what I'm about to do, because this is not me being greedy. This is me trying to atone for a very big problem that I feel like I helped create. And now I feel like I have a responsibility to help solve it. And so does Christo.
And so you went to some major companies. And the first that really embraced was Levi's.
Yes. Yeah.
They got it.
Paul Dillinger, you know. I mean, I was wondering, like, who's going to be the first one to take a chance on our company? Because we talked to a lot of people. We got a lot of people really excited. But Paul was the first one.
And he wrote you the order.
He signed in on as an early adopter. And our early adopter program is a non-binding document. It basically just shows that there's interest. And then it allows us to move into a scoping project. So he signed that just before I went to the Green Challenge in Amsterdam, which is the largest CO2
yes,
competition in the world.
Yes, I remember when you did that.
So I got to confidently stand on stage and say that one global company, you know, had signed on. And I ended up coming back doing a TEDx talk. It was a marathon week doing a TEDx talk and then going to a cabin for a couple of days. And I was sitting in the cabin and I was like, okay, what can I do for Paul that could thank him for taking a chance on us? And Christo and I found an old line down in the Southeast that had been decommissioned, and we were getting some fiber made to be able to show what we could do. So our original idea was we'll do a range of knits and wovens and just show people the capability.
But originally your concept was you were going to be a fabric company.
Originally, yeah, textile mill.
Right. And you were looking at textile mills and how you were going to take them over and the ones that were dead.
Yeah.
Right, but you evolved into something else.
Yes, we met the team in Amsterdam that invented the LED light bulb. They decided to become a manufacturer and they got crushed by Philips and GE. And they were like, we wished we had done it slightly differently. We don't regret the way we got
built
the market to shift.
Right.
Because they got the whole market.
They did get the whole market to shift.
To shift, but they lost their cut.
Right, because they weren't the leaders. And that's an interesting point, because we can look at a lot of different companies. You know, the use of, you know, tampons that are environmentally friendly, or the use of cleaning products that are environmentally healthy. I mean, all these young startups are thinking that way, and then they're creating brands around their products. And I can't help looking at them from an early stage investor and think, well, the big companies, they see it coming.
Yeah.
They're either going to pick them up early or they're just going to change their formulas and crush them.
Yeah.
Because they understand not only is more people want that. The millennials want them. Generation Z wants them. Mm-hmm. And these are the new customers coming down the pipeline.
And they are very powerful. And everyone is terrified of the millennials and the Gen Zers.
As they should be.
Because they don't know how to – I mean, we've got this massive ship. You know, we've created a world where we've got these large industrial complexes. They're very expensive. When large companies see us coming, they get terrified, because a technology like ours could render their PP&E.
You could kill cotton industries.
Well, we couldn't, because we need cotton to grow to make our product.
Right.
And we're not in an all or nothing world. I mean, this industry is projected to double by 2025. So if we've got we're going to double our global industry in 10 years, that is a huge undertaking. And right now, if we're going to do that, we are going to need to regenerate materials that already exist in order to keep up with that demand.
Completely. And so when you left Amsterdam and you heard that from the LID people, what light bulb went off in your head? No pun intended. Yeah.
So I was like, what do we do well? What do we do better than anyone else? And let's like invest in that. What we do well is R&D. We are really good at creating things that outperform anything that people have ever seen. So, you know, our model is a brand or retailer hires us. They say, here's my biggest program or my biggest idea. I want you to work with the team to come up with a concept that will outperform anything that we've ever done before. Look better, feel better, hold color better, and design it to be taken back and disassembled in the future. And I don't want to pay any more for it.
And so you can do that.
We're working on it. We're working on it now. The payment thing, that's where I like to, I mean, I really like to get into good battles over pricing. Because pricing, we have trained the customer to pay less than what things cost.
Oh, you think? I mean, yeah. That is one of the biggest problems. I mean, even back when I was running a company in the garment center, I mean, Walmart would like to say, we want to have it made in the USA. But meanwhile, everything's made in China. And then maybe they assemble something, put a hanger in it. And so it's made in the USA.
Yeah.
And the issue is that people want to pay $6 for a t-shirt.
Right.
But they want their friends who work in the t-shirt factories to make $25 an hour.
Totally
for labor, because that's what the unions are going to pay. But that doesn't equal to a $6 t-shirt.
Right.
That equals to a $125 t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Herein lies the problem.
Herein lies a huge problem.
Totally. So, and when I hear NPR interview people and hear people, real humans in this country say it is cheaper to throw away clothing and buy new than it is to do laundry.
That's scary.
That lit a fire in me so deep. I'm like, why are we selling so cheap? Because what we're doing is we're creating the business model in this industry, as you know, is based on style obsolescence.
Absolutely.
We need people right now. We need people to consume in order to stay in business and create pretty large companies. Mm-hmm. That model, you know, it was interesting when we shifted to the fast fashion model. It was, I think it was the CEO that was hired from, I think it was Zara, came from the dairy industry and applied the same model to clothing as was applied to milk. And milk has a shelf life.
Yes, it does.
And it has to move quickly.
Yes.
So as soon as he readjusted the supply chain systems and everyone was loving it because it was massive growth for the space and consumers were loving it because they had a lot of newness and options.
Right. And they can buy something in terms of when the season is happening. And also technology has changed it so that it doesn't cost you as much You don't get the deal when you make an item and you have to make 1,800 units. You can make one now for the same price.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that you can't buy half a yard.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. And like taking position on raw materials and having the raw materials held so you only have to cut and sew, that also significantly reduces the lead time to get product made.
Completely.
So we made a lot of progress in how we think about our supply chain. But I don't think anyone was thinking about the effect of that model, because everything goes to the consumer and then it's the consumer's problem to figure out how to dispose of it. And the consumer's like, well, I'm going to just donate whatever I can to Goodwill. And they think that their stuff is going to a family in need.
It is not.
I mean, maybe some is.
Some is. I don't want to throw them under the bus, but we know a lot of it is just put in huge, huge, like, piles and wrapped up and shipped off to India.
Well, they bail it and they try to trade it for whatever markets they can get money for. And that has been a really interesting market and will continue. I don't see the rag trade going away anytime soon. But the way in which customers are also disposing of textiles, 80% goes directly into the garbage. So only 20% is being donated because no one thinks people want their old sheets, towels, that one sock.
Right, but if they knew that it went to Goodwill, and they bundled it, and the majority of the goods went actually to Evernew, who was now taking these and breaking them down and distributing them to different manufacturers, be it from Levi's to, you know, Stella McCartney, who you're also doing business with, that all of a sudden that's an interesting way of saving the globe.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole goal. And how do we leverage what other people are already doing? So when Christo and I decided that our model, and Christo Staniff is my business partner, and that should be very clear. I get into a lot of trouble because
he's amazing.
He is amazing, and I'm the talker of the of the bunch. He's the substance behind what we do,
and he has some serious provenance himself.
Yeah, exactly. But he's in the lab working, so he couldn't join me today. So he's busy, but when Christo and I started looking at how are we going to play in the system, our goal is to train people. We own IP. We're IP owners, and we're also service providers. That's how we get paid. If a waste owner wants to hire us to help them figure out how to chemically break down the waste that they've got, happy to do that. Happy to find secondary markets for them as well to be helpful. Brands and retailers, if they want to hire us to build garments that outperform what they currently make, happy to do that.
And you have.
And we have. And then also, now that we've gotten the R&D dialed in, we're almost through QA with two of our early adopters. As soon as we pass that minimum quality assurance, I'm ready for a tech transfer. And now I've got to take that R&D off of our line and get it into a commercial line and figure out how that's going to work. So that's really where we intend to be helpful there, because any mill that makes rayon, cupro, or lyocell can be trained to use our technology. So that's what we're currently trying to figure out. How do we do that tech transfer?
And so when you started, you probably didn't think you were going to be here.
No. No.
And
no
you're
way.
Probably still going somewhere else.
We are.
Yes.
And we're going into the
a whole new world.
A whole new world.
So you're constantly evolving as a company.
And a person.
And as a person for sure.
Yeah.
And you've met these and I mean, even in terms of how you raise money, I mean, that is not something you ever had to do.
No.
But now you had.
I had to raise money once at DuPont. I think I had to get a budget approved. I had only had to get budget approved once in my career. Once you show traction, you never have to really ask for it again.
Right.
Because you have a reputation.
But here you have to continue to ask for money again.
But I had to, when I started this company, you know, I converted my retirement fund into what looks like dental floss. Like, you know, my whole family was like, you are out of your mind, Stacy. Like, you should go get a job. You can't do this. And my dad was the worst because, you know, he got sick. He was at the end of his life. And he's like, I'm going to leave this world not knowing if you have a job or not. And I was like, and my dad also, you know, was the first person in his family to like pull himself out of extreme poverty. Here he is faced with the worst fear in his life that one of his kids
is going to go back to
is going to go back to where he was. And I had to just tell him, Dad, if you knew what I knew and you saw what I saw, you'd be doing the same damn thing.
Right.
And
which is impressive.
I want you to support me on this, because if you can't, I can't come see you anymore.
Well, also at this point, you're unhirable from any company.
Totally.
You know, unhirable. You're unhirable.
I know.
But I think what's interesting is too, is that you've raised, and I told you this when I first talked to you, which is, you're raising money in an industry that majority of people don't understand.
Yeah, a lot of people
don't. And the ones that do understand it are not people that generally give you money.
Right.
They're not investors.
Totally. Which in lies the problem. Like, we come up with this idea and it falls in the realm of invention. And no one knows what we're doing and why it's important, because it looks like a baggie of dental floss. Mm-hmm. And you know, I bring it into brands and retailers and they're very impressed with what we've been able to do.
Of course, because they get it.
Yeah. And they're like, okay, well, when do I write an order? And I'm like, well, we have to develop it first. And they're like, well, how are you going to do that? And I was like, well, you're going to write me an order to develop for you.
Exactly. Which I think I told you. I was like, get them to give you the order so you can do the work, because no one else is going to give you the money.
Right. But it had to be structured differently, which
exactly
puts you into an 18-month negotiation.
Yes.
So the whole time it's like
frustrating.
Is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? So One thing has happened in me over the last 18 months. I've gotten super aggressive. Super aggressive. I have no time for maybes. It's like, here's what we do. Here's where you fit in. Here's what we intend to do for you. You call me when you're ready. Next.
Well, which is amazing because I think also you know that you have value and you have been able to transform the early stage adapters like the guy from Levi's and then proven that you have done it. And so you're like, someone else is going to do it because I am going to succeed in this.
Yeah.
And I think women in general at the beginning tend to be very unsure and want to make sure everything's great. And then once they realize, wait a second, I know exactly what I'm doing.
Right,
and if you don't want in, screw you.
Exactly. I think you were the one who told me, never apologize. If I hear I'm sorry from you one more time, like, this is not going to go well for you. So I had to strip it.
As you
and
should.
Get super direct. It's like, no, don't ask me open-endedly, you know, when can you meet at some point in the future? Say, you're available on Monday from 10 to 2. What time are we meeting?
Yes.
Question mark.
Yes.
So I have had to move my approach to being much more direct.
But it works.
And I'm actually having fun now. Because to me, this world has already been created. This has already been done. It's
so
already
the
in the world.
What's the future of Evernew? What's the future of materials? And what's the future of how people, you know, of what we're wearing and throwing into the garbage?
Yeah. So the current reality is that other people are not in my future yet. So I have to put myself in their shoes. So we're talking to these mastodons of industries, huge companies. And they're like, Stace, how much money am I going to make? How much am I going to spend? And I'm like, I don't know. That's dependent on two things. What is our intent to build together? And how deep of a relationship can we create together to create something that doesn't exist in the world yet? Making you money is a non-negotiable. How much we make is totally up to how we're going to design this. And I'm open to making you as much money as I possibly can, because this needs to happen. And it's tough, though, because in their reality, they need to know just bottom line, how much am I making?
Exactly.
They want to go straight to transaction. And I'm like, we got a long way to go before we get to a transaction. We will get there, but I can't give you that
number now. And so how far are we along before we start seeing your materials in stores that we are like, wow, this is powered by Evernew?
Yeah.
And these materials are, you know, reprocessed from old materials that are saving the globe.
Yeah. I am not allowed to say when my brands would be setting products. I got in a lot of trouble.
Sooner than later?
Yes. I hope next year,
okay.
But it's totally up to them. Disclaimer, I am not in control
right,
of when my
right.
brands set product. They are in, it's their sole discretion when they actually sell product. But our goal is to get product to retail next year.
Okay.
We've got a long way to go on that, obviously. The fiber also doesn't have an FTC code because it can't be called cotton. It can't be called rayon. It can't be called lyocell.
No, it's a new paradigm.
There are 25 generic fibers on the planet. Mm-hmm. This is a new generic. The DNA of our fiber says we make cotton without growing anything. But it's just a bunch of different grades of cotton. So it's still got to go through the FTC filing and stuff. And
got it.
Again, lawyers, they will siphon all of the cash from your business if you're not careful.
For sure. But you're not going to let that happen.
No, hell no. I've gotten a reputation of being the Joan Collins of attorneys.
I like
it. I'd love to fire them.
So the future is that we all hope that everything we purchase in our lives
yes.
will have little tags on there powered by Evernew.
Well, you know, we're not in an all or nothing world. I don't think we'll ever be in a world where everything says powered by Evernew
on it.
But
it would be a good place to be.
It would be a great concept for any virgin material that's created, having a regenerative counterpart to break that down and reuse it again saves everybody in the end. So it's really a matter of how do we give at the same rate we take. And to me, that is the basic sustainable model. balance, giving and taking at the same rate. It's not about not consuming. It's about consuming and breaking things down in a smart way so you can consume. I mean, fashion has always been one of those cultural indicators that determines our society.
100%.
We cannot get rid of our fashion, our art, our music, our culinary abilities. These are things that bring people together. It's just how we do it is up for review. And that's what I think is one of the greatest design challenges of our century. And I love being in that problem because I love fixing big problems.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Joanne. I appreciate it.
I want to thank Stacy for joining us on the podcast. You can go to Evernew, that is EVRNU.com, and check out how they are setting out to really change the textile industry and change the world.